Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your ticket to ride the fun bus through the last 7 days in the high-tech world. My name is Bobby Johnson, once again standing in for the lovely Alex Kotoski, and for the next 20 minutes or so, I'll be your guide on a magical mystery tour as we try and shed some light on the hot topics for today and for tomorrow. In the week that the world steals itself for the Beatles' edition of Rock Band, we're going to avoid all things Fab Four. First up, we're going to spend some time with paperback writer and communication pioneer Howard Rheingold. He's the doyen of virtual communities and the author of influential Tome Smart Mobs. Then we'll talk to interface designer Asa Raskin of Mozilla Labs, the place where the creators of Firefox work on new experimental projects. So let's all get back to where we once belong and come together as we head into another episode of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Okay, I promise that's it with all the lame Beatles puns. They're getting worse and worse. Now, it's time to get down to some serious business with this week's first interviewee. Since he first became involved in the high-tech communication industry in the 1960s, Howard Rheingold's name has managed to weave its way in and out of the history of the super-connected world. Back in the 1970s, Howard worked on and wrote about some of the earliest personal computers coming out of the legendary Xerox PARC facility. That's the same place that pioneered the graphical user interface we all use on our computers every day. Then, throughout the 80s and 90s, he was an integral member of the world's first online community, The Well, and in 2002 went on to author a prescient book called Smart Mobs, about how to harness collective intelligence online. These days he's a fellow at the Institute for the Future in Silicon Valley, a lecturer at the University of California in Berkeley, and a visiting lecturer at Stanford. Busy man indeed. Fortunately, Kevin Anderson managed to eke some time out to find out more from Howard, and he started by asking him to explain the tensions that come up whenever we develop a new communications tool.
One of the things that you talked about in your speech and your presentation was a bit of a tension between how these tools aren't necessarily just implicitly good, that there's a tension, and you know, it's almost a comic book stereotype that with great power comes great responsibility. How do we societies kind of navigate that these tools are really powerful, but they can be used for good, and they can be used for other things that aren't so positive?
Well, I think it's always been true that particular tools have positive and negative uses. Of course, you're not going to try to hammer a nail with a gun, and a gun has a particular use. And you're probably not going to be very successful in warfare if you just use hammers. So I'm not saying that tools are completely neutral, but I think that clearly we understand with information technologies now that the social aspect, that the ways in which people understand and the ways in which they pass around knowledge and the ways in which they develop social practices are very important. And we've moved from the era in which a few people, necessarily with wealth, have the ability to broadcast, because it's expensive to have a television station or to print a newspaper. Now, of course, every desktop and every telephone is both a printing press and a broadcasting station and a community and a marketplace. It's a radical democratization of the power to communicate. But does democratization necessarily mean democracy? I think we can see that people are using communication technologies to organize conflict as well as peaceful and democratic means. So to me, the most important difference is education, that the social institution where you intervene in what people know is by educating them. And we have very, very little education about how do you use information technologies properly, or how do you use them effectively, or how do you use them in a beneficial way? So if we're going to do something about fostering healthy technology use and discouraging unhealthy use, I think it has to do with education, whether that's in the school system or otherwise.
So one of the groups that's definitely trying to educate itself and come up to speed is our journalists. Do you see any easy wins, if you will, simple things that journalists could do to further use some of these collaborative technologies to actually do some incredibly powerful journalism?
My method of teaching and my advice is to do it. Blog, wiki, RSS. You see how it feels to use these things. And I think not only does the direct experience of using new tools gives you insights that you wouldn't have gotten out of a textbook, these particular tools put you in touch with communities of others. So one of the things you learn is, how do I find the other journalists who are using new technologies? And of course, that applies to anything from medicine to education to commerce. But particularly for journalists, it's no longer the crusty old editor in the newsroom or the journalism professor. It's your peers, wherever they are in the world, who are discovering new things and sharing that with each other. So we have a huge opportunity. You don't have to gain entrance to and pay a huge tuition fee to a school to learn. And access to the internet and to mobile technologies is relatively inexpensive. So I would urge journalists to learn how to use the tools, but to use the tools to get in touch with others who know more than you do.
Now, you said democratization doesn't lead necessarily to democracy, and you teach courses on digital journalism. Of course, one of the concerns right now is that because of financial problems that news organizations are having, that this will have a detrimental impact on democracy itself. Are you concerned about that? And how do you think some of the democratic functions that journalists do can actually not end, even when some of the institutions of journalism might go away?
I've been concerned for some time about the role of citizen communication and journalism in democracy as our information technologies have changed. Of course, the theory of the public sphere is that democracy is not just about voting for your leaders. It's about talking with other informed citizens who are free to speak and who have access to information about the workings of the state, in which you debate and you form public opinion, and public opinion influences the state. Now, there's been an argument for a long time. The political theorist Habermas or the journalist Walter Lippmann have said the use of communication media from the newspaper to the internet to manipulate opinion is so sophisticated, and there's so much money and power behind it, that we're really fooling ourselves if we think that we live in a democracy that emerges from free citizens having discussions with each other. Of course, that was at the beginning of the 20th century, nearly a century ago. And in response, John Dewey said, well, if citizens are ignorant and manipulated, maybe we need better journalism so they're less ignorant, and they need we need better educational institutions so they are less easily manipulated. I don't think that our educational institutions or our enterprises that support journalism can possibly change as quickly as the technologies are. So we're seeing a real conflict between the ways in which people are communicating in new ways every day, the ways in which those in power use those technologies to not only persuade, but to manipulate others. Those are advancing very rapidly. So I think it's not just journalists, but the consumers of journalism who need to be educated. This is not literally rocket science, but life in the era we're living now, particularly if we want to have healthy democracies, depends on critical thinking. You can find the answer to any question that you have. You can literally pluck it out of the air. But do you know whether it's information, misinformation, disinformation, or subtly manipulated information? That kind of critical thinking is not taught in the school. So I think if I was to be asked what's the easy answer, it's to teach critical thinking. The hard part is how do you do that in a school where you got to get your students to sit down and behave? But at least addressing that issue, I think, is very important right now.
In the near future, say the next 5 years or so, where do you see journalism, however you defined it, professional journalism, citizen journalism, where do you see it going, both from a technological standpoint, a financial standpoint, where do you think we'll be?
I think we need to distinguish between the news business and the financial economic institutions that have supported it, and journalism, the practice of finding the story, verifying the story, and telling the story and getting it out to people. There are more and more people doing the latter, not all of them professionals. The former, the institutions, we're seeing newspapers go out of business, and clearly broadcast media like television and radio are also under pressure as well, and nobody really knows what's going to happen with the what's been called the unbundling of news. There's plenty of ways to get news. There are more ways for an individual with a little bit of knowledge to get news than ever before. Will people have a picture of what is happening in the world? And I think that that's an important and legitimate concern for democracies. We have seen before in times of change when old institutions crumble that that's an opportunity for new institutions to be formed. And we really haven't seen the new institutions formed in terms of how do journalists get paid. But we're seeing all kinds of ways of capturing and communicating news events, from the mobile phone to Twitter to Wikipedia. You know, when there's a major event in the world, go to the Wikipedia article about it and watch on a minute-to-minute basis as people are using news sources from around the world to aggregate them. We're seeing all kinds of innovations. How those innovations are going to shake out into a regime in which most people in the world have access to relatively accurate news about what's happening in the rest of the world, that's really a critical uncertainty now.
That was Kevin Anderson speaking to Howard Rheingold there. And if you've got to get Howard into your life, the best place to start is probably his website, rheingold.com, where you can find information, articles, and links to his books. Now that's enough of that. I think it's time for this week's news.
A new version of the board game classic Monopoly has caught the public's imagination thanks to a tie-in to Google Maps. The new version, called Monopoly City Streets, allows players to buy any street in the world. The game, which is being backed by the makers of Monopoly, Hasbro, is running for a four-month trial. The much-vaunted music application Spotify took another step forward this week by launching a version for mobile phones. Premium users paying £10 a month can use the app on their iPhone or Android handset, allowing them to listen to thousands of songs on demand. A new anti-piracy campaign is targeting what it calls Generation Y Pay. It's being backed by actors including the former EastEnders star Tamsin Althwaite and The Wire's Dominic West. The campaign comes after the music industry body, the BPI, said it hoped that new laws to cut suspected file sharers from the internet could be passed within a year. And finally, staff at PC World and Currys are in big trouble after it emerged they were calling customers stupid and ignorant on a Facebook group for company employees. Parent group DSG said it was investigating the comments.
Thanks very much for that roundup, and you can keep up with these stories and many more throughout the week by going to guardian.co.uk/technology. Time now to put the spotlight on our second interviewee, who is just 25 years old but has already made a name for himself in the world of software. Asa Raskin is the head of user interface at Mozilla, the company behind open source web browser Firefox and a number of other products. In particular, Asa works tirelessly, some might even say 8 days a week, on the company's labs scheme, where experimental software is developed and pushed through. Our Kevin once again caught up with him to find out what was going on, and started by asking him to outline some of the specific projects he's working on at the moment.
So we're working on a couple of them, three major ones. There's something called Weave, something called Ubiquity or TaskFox, and something called Personas are the sort of the really interesting ones at the moment. Ubiquity asks the question, what happens if, sort of in the Star Trek way, you could talk to your computer, sort of conversational computer, say, I want to add a map to my email. Well, why can't you just say, map this, or map 2418 Washington Street? Why can't you say, spell check, or edit image? And really just write what you want to do. Instead of surfing the web, just command it. So that's what Ubiquity is about. It's currently being used by around 400,000 people, still in alpha state though. Weave is about asking, why when you walk away from your computer, does your experience not come with you? I'm sitting at my computer, I make a reservation for, I don't know, a restaurant. I walk out the door and you realize, ah, I forgot to write that down. All of a sudden your choices are A, you walk back to your house, well, that's sort of suboptimal, or B, you sort of browse on your phone for a while trying to get back that information, but of course that information isn't there, it hasn't come to your inbox. that actually takes a while. Why can't it be the case that when I'm at my computer, I walk out the door, that very same tab that I just had open, why isn't that already on your phone? Why do I have to retype my passwords when trying to type on a phone is trying to remove a contact lens with a cotton ball? Right? It's a difficult prospect. And Personas is a little bit more fun. That just lets you change the browser to look the way you want it to look. So if you like Harry Potter, you can go make it look like Harry Potter. If you like the Red Cross, you can have your browser look like a Red Cross, that kind of stuff.
So with Ubiquiti, I've used it just a little bit, but I guess probably the average user is saying, well, how is this different than, say, a search engine? How is it different than, you know, Google or Ask or something like that?
So let me give a problem description that I think that'll make that clear. I want to translate something on a page. I see something in Japanese, I want to translate it into English. Right now, the steps to do that are A, you select it, B, you copy it, C, you now have to go to the search engine and look for a translation service. You type translate in there, right? I don't remember what step I'm on, but the next one, I think, was D. You now paste that text in. E, you then select the language you want to translate to. F, you click the button. And G, you finally get your translation back. And now you have to close that window, head back, and try desperately to retain your train of thought, right? That used a search engine. But what you really want to do is just be able to select on page that text and literally say, translate this. You want your browser to know that you speak English or whatever language you speak. You want it to be able to detect what language it came from. And you want it to just put that translation right back in the page where it came from. So you go from around 12 steps to 1. And in that change, you save your train of thought, you save your time, and you save frustration, you save having to learn all those separate steps. That's what Ubiquiti does, but sort of ad infinitum all over the web.
So that's what you're working on right now. What are the problems that you see that you'd really like to solve?
So natural language is very, very difficult. In fact, it's so difficult that we don't do it. It looks like we do, but we don't. We cheat as much as possible. We are your browser, so we know your context. So if you use email, we might know that you use Gmail or might know you use Yahoo Mail. If you say somebody like email this to my friend Jono, it'll figure out who that is because it knows your address book and move forward and then get back their email address. So moving forward, we've just figured out how to let people sort of localize this natural language, this sort of cheating in natural language to other languages. We have to make that better. We have to make the specificity of when you type something in, how do we make it clearer which things you can type in, right? The sort of recognition versus recall problem. How do you know out of all the things in the English language that this is something you can do? And finally, right now we have thousands of commands. We have an amazing community of people that are contributing to this open source project, but we need to work on making those commands really hit very specific use cases that can be used for 300 million people.
Where's the near-term future of the web? Everyone always asks me this question. You know, what are we going to be doing in two or three years? I mean, what would you like to be doing on the web in a couple of years?
So I think the more pervasive a technology is, the more invisible. I think if we go 10 years out, you're not going to think of using the web as you use the web. You're going to be walking down the street, you're going to think, I wonder what the local team got in their cricket score, or whatever you people say, and that answer will come back to your ear. And you'll be using the internet, you'll be using the web, but you won't realize it. So every step we take from here to 10 years out is to figure out how do we make this technology disappear so that you're interacting more with people and the information that you want to be interacting with, and less with a piece of technology.
Thank you very much.
Aza Raskin of Mozilla there. And you can find out more about some of the projects he mentioned by visiting labs.mozilla.com or by catching his blog at azarask.in. Links should be on the show page if you want them. Okay, that's about it for this week's show, but before I head off once again into the cryogenic storage unit they keep me in between podcasts, I wanted just to dig through some of the feedback you gave us on last week's show. Now, if you remember, that episode came from the weird and wonderful world of the Singularity University in Silicon Valley, and it proved a talking point for several of you. In the comments, Kesthilm said it sounded like a course in megalomania, while Scaro suggested that the students should focus their ambitions on things like basic sanitation and clean water. I guess a global plumbing initiative was beneath these visionary minds. Actually, in their defense, I just wanted to say the team we heard from in last week's show were actually looking at how to roll out infrastructure like plumbing and electricity at the same time as printing the houses out of concrete that they told us about. They were thinking bigger, I suppose. TJ Huggs, on the other hand, was more enthusiastic, saying what incredible tools such technology enables us to imagine and build. I wish they had a similar setup here. Best message of the week, though, was from Mark Stedman, who said nothing to do with the Singularity University and instead had a tip for listening to the show, which is, let me tell you, listen to the show at 2x speed and Bobby Johnson sounds like he's talking at normal speed. Nice, thanks Mark. What you don't realise is that by the time this show actually gets to your ears, I've already been sped up 16 times, so things start to fall apart once you take the jump to light speed. Anyway, if you've got anything to say, you can drop us a line in the blog comments. You can go to our Facebook group, which I admit has been sorely neglected of late, so apologies for that. Or you can follow us on Twitter. You can find us at GuardianTW. I just want to say we do always appreciate your comments, your criticisms, and especially your jokes, since they're always better than ours. With all that done, there's just time for me to thank our guests, Howard Rheingold and Asa Raskin, as well as intrepid interviewer Kevin Anderson and this week's producer Ian Chambers. Thank you for listening. My name's Bobby Johnson. Hello, goodbye, and see you next Tuesday.